Hello and welcome. You are listening to the Rational Faiths podcast, which is a project that's focused on keeping Mormonism weird, right? I am Brian Kissel.
And I am Brian Dillman.
And Ben, you get to say, I am Ben.
And I'm Benjamin Knoll.
Wonderful. Oh, and one of the things I was going to say, some say that, if you haven't listened to this podcast before, some say that this is the best podcast on the Blabbernacle, right? So you're in for a treat because that's an objective truth and it's totally undeniable.
Absolutely.
But anyways, I'm very excited about today's episode as we are going to be, Brian's already announced this series that we're going to be doing focused on some different issues related to cognitive biases, as well as diving within the realm of psychology, you know, and self-deception kind of science. We are using a book titled You Are Not So Smart by David McCraney. And we'll just be going through some of these differing ideas, talking about them a little bit, talking about some of the research that is included within that book, but also really discussing how this applies or relates to Mormonism and religion and how we just as individuals can kind of interpret some of this differing information. So what I'm going to do is we're going to jump into a little clip of a little presentation, quick little thing, where I'll be talking about priming. So let's go ahead and just do that, which kind of covers the chapter on priming from You Are Not So Smart. So let's go ahead and get into that. You are influenced by more than you know. All right, so I would encourage you to take a moment to consider your environment. You know, I'm personally sitting at a computer surrounded by pictures of my family, office supplies, a telephone, images on the wall, etc. Perhaps you are in your car where you are surrounded by walls and glass. There are various electronic knobs around you, and perhaps there are even books, paper, garbage, etc. in there with you. You may have been listening to the radio, or earlier you could have been watching television or a particular movie or something like that. Perhaps you were playing a video game, participating in a heated debate on Facebook, or maybe like drinking a Red Bull, right, or a different beverage. I ask you to bring all this to your attention because many of us would believe that these surroundings would have little impact on our decisions, emotions, and thoughts. And yet, the truth is that we are influenced much more than we might know. Many of us believe that we know when we are being influenced and how it is affecting our behavior. The problem is that if we believe this, we are probably wrong. The truth is that we are likely unaware of the constant nudgings, right, we receive from ideas formed in our unconscious minds. I will thus be describing and discussing the topic of priming in this post, which I will do by sharing some of the different experiments and studies that have been done in this area. Many of the studies are fairly trippy, and it is often difficult to believe that these influences are real at first glance, and yet there is a strong body of good scientific research to back them up. That is the beauty of taking a scientific approach to behavior. Right? We do not have to rely on our hunches and folk wisdom, and instead we can do our very best to test our hypotheses and then to follow the data. So on one occasion where researchers were seeking to test a particular hypothesis, Chenbo Zhang and Katie Lindquist gathered participants one by one into a room where they were asked to remember an awful past sin and then recount details. Half of these individuals were given the chance to wash their hands, and the others were not. What is interesting is that they gave them all the chance to help a needy graduate student in a future project, and those who washed their hands said that they would help 43% of the time, while those who did not were willing to help 74% of the time. And kind of a quick imagining of why that would be, you know, it's like you're washing away that necessity, right? That need to remember your sins or redeem yourself. You know, those who wash their hands, they are less likely to want to help this individual. In another study performed by Aaron Kay, Christian Wheeler, John Barghand, and Lee Ross, they put individuals through an exercise where some participants matched up neutral items with their corresponding words, you know, like those puzzles that you see in like kid books where you're matching up a definition with a word, you know, while others matched up business-related words. Okay, so they would have like a briefcase, you know, going to the word briefcase, or a picture of a fountain pen or whatever it happened to be. After this priming exercise, they were given the chance to engage in the ultimatum game. Simply put, the ultimatum game is an exercise where one person is able to make an offer of how much a sum of money will be split. So it could be 50-50, it could be 60-40, or even like 90-10, or whatever. And the catch is that the other person has the power to reject or accept the offer. And if it is rejected, neither of them receives anything. Now, in the scenario where individuals were primed with the photos of business items, only 33% chose to split the money evenly, while those primed with the neutral photos chose to split the money 91% of the time. And again, isn't that so fascinating? Just by doing this simple little exercise, doing this little crossword kind of thingy, you know, that you, this little puzzle that you would do in a crossword book or something like that, where you're matching up a word with its image, you know, just because they're primed with a business like some of these images or some of these ideas that come from business imagery, you may be less likely to behave in, like, to split the money fairly or whatever. And many related studies have been performed finding very similar results. When people are primed with items related to business, they tend to act more aggressively in these types of negotiation scenarios. Okay, and another one. John Barg ran a few studies which also had very interesting results. You know, in one experiment, he gave participants the task of unscrambling sentences made of polite, neutral, or rude word combinations, and were told to come and get the researcher once they were finished. Okay, so you can imagine yourself, you go in this room and you're unscrambling these words. Now, when they arrived where the researcher was at, they go to get him, they saw that the researcher was engaged in a conversation with a colleague. So, and although it was actually a confederate, it was part of the experiment. And they were attempting to see whether those primed with the rude words would be more likely to interrupt the researcher. And those primed with the polite words waited around 9.3 minutes to interrupt. Those primed with the neutral words waited about 8.7 minutes. And those primed with the rude words waited around 5.4 minutes. Okay, those primed with the rude words were much more likely or much quicker in interrupting the researcher to let them know that they had finished the task. 80% of those primed with the polite words waited to the full 10 minutes, while only 35% of those primed with the rude words group, you know, chose to not interrupt. So this is just a very quick general idea of what this is. You know, these are just a couple of experiments, and there's been so much research, especially with priming, and looking into a lot of the different concepts that we are going to be talking about in the future. I mean, priming is just a very fascinating technique that can be used, but I think in and of itself, it describes this really interesting phenomenon that we were talking about before, that we are more influenced than we would perhaps imagine. You know, priming research is extremely vast and can span from the types of studies just mentioned to studies on the impact of violent and sexual media on individuals. You know, priming relates to embodied cognition research, as well as research on marketing and brands. From the smells of a bakery to marketing strategies from Facebook and Amazon. And I think it's important to recognize that many understand this research and are indeed trying to influence us in differing ways. This is why being aware of this research is so important, particularly because priming tends to be less effective if you are aware of it. So if you are aware of some of these things, some of these pieces of your environment and how they may be influencing you, I think that can be very helpful as we're attempting to make decisions. Thus, the suggestion that I would make in this post is to simply attempt to be more cognizant of our surroundings. What are our goals? Right? Is our environment playing a role in hurting our chances of success? Are we attempting to be productive in our careers and trying to get as much out of work as possible? You know, and yet our desks are messy and disorganized. You know, do we want to be part of a happy work environment, and yet we often are sending a different message by the way we treat others? So much that surrounds us will play a role in our decisions and actions, and I think that it is important for us to be more aware of that. With that short little summary, let's go ahead and jump back into the group discussion. Fantastic. So as I said before, I'm really excited for us to be able to talk about some of these things. Maybe we could start out with this panel discussion that we're getting into now. Maybe you guys could talk about what you thought about when you heard that we were going to be discussing priming, or what is priming to you, and why would that kind of be an interesting topic or something important for us to think about as Mormons, or just as that's kind of the focus of what we're doing?
Well, for me, as I didn't know what priming was in a psychological usage of the word, but the word means you're preparing something. Primer is what you put down before you paint.
Yeah.
So I figured it's going to be something that that changes you or prepares you to, I imagine, work, behave in a certain way. And as I read the chapter, it was really interesting to learn about small, subtle things that have a significant impact on our behavior. Especially the parts about washing and how that makes you feel maybe not so guilty for whatever you've done in the past, and therefore in the experiment less likely to be helpful to other people.
Right,
driven by guilt.
So the implication of that is don't wash your hands and you'll be a nicer person.
You'll be a better person. That's right. Cleanliness is not next to God.
Yeah. Disproven. What did you think, Ben?
Okay, so for me, this is interesting to me through what I do for my work. I'm a political science professor, and I teach classes about public opinion and voting. And in some of my classes, we have a short unit on political psychology, and specifically how the media can shape our political opinions. And priming comes into that really, really strongly. So we'll have lessons on how the media can cover certain topics or things in the news, and that can affect people's political opinions about political candidates, who they're going to vote for, their approval or disapproval of different policies and their preferences, and that sort of thing. And it's always really interesting to teach that to the students, because I ask them then, like, think about what you're seeing throughout the day in terms of the political environment, and how is that going to affect then your opinions, your conversations, and the things that happen to you later on in that same day, just based on some of the things that happened to you earlier in the day. And that's always a fun thing to talk about with students, the effect to which we like to think that we have a lot of control over our opinions and what we think about things, but it's always fascinating to get insights into just how little we actually have conscious control over why we think the way we do about all sorts of things.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think last week you mentioned that I was trying to get into graduate school. I got the offer, so I accepted it. And the advisor that I am going to be working with, he does some stuff on like the impact of media and like violent video games and some of these different things. And I think that's an interesting topic related to priming as well, where it's like, I think a lot of people, like that area, a lot of people don't really realize how much research has been done in that area, you know, and how something like violent or sexual media or some of these different things can really have these strong impacts that we can kind of do very good experimental research on to get to that. So it's just so fascinating to me how much we can be influenced by the differing things that are around us.
Yeah, absolutely.
So maybe we could talk a little bit about priming in related to Mormonism or religion. So what are some of these kind of primes that you guys are thinking about? Some of these things that are influencing us within maybe Mormonism?
Well, one of the things that came to mind right away was the discussion about the hand washing bit. It made me think about baptism or taking the sacrament or any religious ritual that has water involved in it. And you can look up religious rituals involving water, and there's tons of rituals. I mean, just in Mormonism, you have baptism, you have the sacrament, I guess it should be wine. Maybe that's a bad example, but you have washings and anointings, and in biblical times, they had lots of washings. In Hinduism, they also, the clergy will also wash themselves. So this cleanliness and this effect that water has on us as a human species is really interesting. And so as I was on that track thinking about rituals, I'm jumping ahead to some of the other ideas that are in the book, like embodied or enclothed cognition,
yeah,
where our posture affects the way we think and the way we feel, and what we wear can affect the way that we act. And so that made me think about going to church, and you wear certain clothes for church to with the expectation and often the result of having a specific experience. And so all these things around us, I mean, the shape of the building, the familiarity of the sacrament prayers or the hymns, how we dress, all those things make the religious experience what it is, or at least maybe not they don't make the experience what it is, but they contribute to the experience.
Yeah, so much so that people will feel, well, you have those differing conversations about like white and black kind of shirts and those things,
yeah.
but also like women wearing pants to church or something like that, you know,
yeah,
where you're going outside of that kind of a norm thing, and which, and people were getting very upset about that. Like, I think that that's interesting, thinking of that as being that kind of a prime that is kind of showing us, oh, we're in this environment, we're in this kind of a thing that's normal. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, and you add in another element and it kind of ruins it for some people.
Yeah.
I think that was interesting what Brian said about the way that religious buildings are designed. There's a lot of, and I'm not an expert on this by any means, I just like read like one or two little articles on it, but
that's the internet.
you're expert. Yeah, good job. Sure.
But like the theory of architecture design and how the shape of buildings and the way they're put together can influence the way that people, like the attitudes that they have or what they're thinking about when they're in those buildings. A couple of months ago, I was able to go to England for a couple of weeks as part of my job for a study abroad trip. And we visited a whole lot of religious buildings. Like, we went to St. Paul's Cathedral in London. We went out to a number of cathedrals in places like Bath. And we went to, like, an ancient temple. We went to Stonehenge. And it was interesting just to see what that was like to go to those places. The themes that came up to me over and over again was that, A, mostly they were made of stone, right? And the stone made me think, you know, old. It made me think permanent. It made me think tradition, you know, that kind of thing. And these stones all pointed up. Like, you go into the building and you see lines all going up, 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 up. And these buildings are extremely tall, and it's hard not to have your thoughts drawn upward, you know, when you go into these buildings with the thinking that, wow, this is a high, high, high building. It's really big. And the effect it had on me just standing next to these or standing inside of them was, wow, I'm little, I'm small, I'm insignificant compared to the grandeur of this building. And so if the intention of the architects who put these together was to make you feel humble in God's presence, that sure worked for me. And I was just going there, you know, as kind of an academic trip. I wasn't even there as part of a religious service, but crazy effective. Just having those elements in your environment certainly primed me to be thinking about things in a certain way than otherwise I might not have been if I was just in like a school room or outside or in a movie theater or something like that.
What you said reminded me of a paper that I read, and I just can't find it.
Hit Control F.
That's always my fallback.
Yeah.
Dang it, only
Control F.
It doesn't work when they're actual printed out papers.
I guess while you're looking at that, something else that interesting was, so I go into these old cathedrals and these old churches, and what do you see in the floor all over the place? You see grave sites, right? It's like in all these churches, people are buried there in the floor. And I was reflecting on that and thinking, my first thought was, you know, do I want to be going to church around a bunch of a dead people, you know, kind of a thing? But then as I thought a little bit more about it, and then after we went to Stonehenge and they talked about how Stonehenge was often used as a burial site, with the idea that you put people near the sacred sites, And I thought to myself, well, that actually is not too dissimilar. I mean, not in the exact same way, but in Mormon temples, we might not have the people buried right there, but we're certainly thinking of our dead, right? Thinking of dead people constantly while we're in there doing ordinances on behalf of the dead. We use that language even, saying on behalf of so-and-so who is dead. And
is that why they put the baptistry in the basement of temples? Is it just for functional reasons in case it floods? Or is it supposed to be...
Oh, a baptism, does it have going underground.
Yeah,
right?
Going underground, being buried.
Being below ground level.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be...
I think that's designed that way, but I could be wrong.
Yeah. So I was thinking there, it's like just as in Mormon temples, those ordinances remind us to think of our ancestors, which then give us motivation to behave better or to do better or to try to be better Christians or whatever. I thought maybe it did the same thing for those people hundreds of years ago, to go to those religious places to worship and be constantly reminded of those who've passed on before them in their environment might A, help remind them of their own mortality and maybe spark them to be thinking about, I need to be taking care of my soul. I need to be worrying about this because before too long, it's going to be me here.
And also with the goal, at least in the LDS context, and I imagine this is not unique to Mormon thought, but with the goal of being reunited with those that are already dead, with the dead. The dead. Like on Lord of the Rings. The dead.
Indeed. And I'm sure there's more to it than that, because as I understand it, wasn't it the case that back in the day... that a person needed to be buried, like, on church grounds in order to be able to be saved or whatever. So that might have also had that function as well. But just thinking about religious places, what does it prime us to think about, even without us being consciously aware of it? And then how does then that affect, without our even knowing, our conscious thoughts when we're in those places and what we're pondering on and thinking about?
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. These last few weeks, I've been looking up lots of different psychology papers on religion and priming, right? And those were some of the key words. And I found tons of research that was really interesting. And what you said about like the architecture and the building, there's something about that environment that can really impact us. This one paper that I was reminded of, it's called Activating Christian Religious Concepts Increases Intolerance of Ambiguity and Judgment Certainty. So they were looking at this idea of ambiguity intolerance, right? Of being uncomfortable with uncertainty. And they were looking at whether priming religion or priming some of these differing concepts would make people, would influence people to be more uncomfortable with uncertainty. And the study that I was thinking of, there was one where they took individuals in a cathedral versus in a secular, in like just the civic square or something. And they were looking at these differing students in these differing places, and they provided them with the ambiguity scale, and those who were just being in that environment in the cathedral were more likely to be a little bit more uncomfortable with uncertainty or with ambiguity. And so I think it's fascinating that just, again, how some of these things that you wouldn't necessarily think about, right? Some of these things that are surrounding us, how they can influence in ways that we wouldn't even consider.
Right, absolutely. I guess I could contribute to that there. That's also been shown to be the case in political science research, that so being in a situation of crisis or threat is also very much related to the lack of tolerance for ambiguity. And that's been shown, like, so there was some research around like 9/11 or some of these other places that the populace tended to react in a much stronger kind of black and white kind of thinking, whereas when things are going well and the economy is doing good, the public tends to show a greater tolerance for the more shades of gray kind of approach to thinking about, at least about political questions and things.
So when your mortality is brought to your consciousness, you're more prone to get serious. Like, all right, we got to get this right, boys. Right.
And I guess what is religion, if not a lot of reminders about our own mortality?
Yeah.
Which I guess helps to me explain why people who are just like what your research paper was saying, people who are more religious tend to, not always, of course, but tend to also have less tolerance for ambiguity in their thinking patterns.
Yep. And in a couple other studies that I was looking into, I mean, those kind of religious primes, often are, well, I guess I'm kind of repeating the same thing, but where they are influencing people to be much more uncomfortable with uncertainty, but also are thinking in different ways as well, you know, so there's lots of differing contributions. I think it's fascinating. Did you guys think of any other kind of primes related to like Mormonism and that we could think about or talk about?
Yeah, so one that came to my mind, we just talked about how your physical environment can act as primes on your attitudes and thoughts. Another thing that we talked about a little bit is, so a parallel to political science research, oftentimes the objective of the study is to see, so what role is the media having on priming our thinking about political candidates and political ideas and elections and that kind of thing? But in a religious context, and again, specifically in the Mormon context, the messages we get from our political leaders and the political institute, or sorry, not the political, the religious leaders.
Hey, you know. Church and state.
This is what I talk about all day, every day. No, okay, so.
This isn't Rome.
Okay, so what I meant to say is when we're in a context when we're receiving very frequent messages from our religious leaders and our religious institution, that too can act as primes on our attitudes and thinking about all sorts of other things. And I'm thinking specifically, what kinds of messages are we primed with during like general conference talks or devotionals broadcast or CES devotionals or from Sunday school lessons or from sacrament meeting talks or from church-sponsored social media posts or images that they choose to put up on their website or share on Twitter or things like that. Like, all of those things can then contribute to our subconsciousness, which then affect other things that we're thinking about without our awareness throughout the day, throughout the week, so on and so forth.
So one example might be one that grinds my gears is the Second Coming talks and the Signs of the Times, where you talk about wars and rumors of wars and natural disasters and the moon turning to blood or getting kind of orangish depending on the the pollution level, you know. But then that can prime you to I guess this is kind of confirmation bias, to notice the things in the news that are awful. And notice all the wars going on, and you know, you pick up on all those things, and you're like, "Good grief, he's coming any day now." Rather than noticing everything and noticing the good things that are going on, which the media has already selected out because it doesn't get as much interest or airplay.
Mm, certainly, and it's interesting to me that there's been a couple of stories in the media lately just talking about how, I mean, the kicker is, despite popular belief, things are getting a lot better in a lot of ways in the United States. So there's these studies coming out showing that adolescent behavior is actually like the best it's been in generations. Like, they're staying in school longer, they're being put in jail less, they're engaging in less risky behaviors than like than any in the last several generations, the last 50 years or so. But that's not what we would think hearing general conference talks or, you know, anything like that. The
kids these days.
Right, exactly. That's what we get there. And there's a lot of interesting things coming about, like the stability of marriages, too, and these kinds of things. The kinds of messages we would get coming from our religious leaders doesn't always match up 100% with the empirical evidence coming out of the research showing that, you know, in a lot of ways we have, yes, fewer people are getting married, but those marriages are lasting and more stable lots of times than they have been in the past. And that's just one example, but yeah. There's lots of things like that. Also just like world peace, wars, and all this kind of stuff. There's other things out there that compared to much in world history, the world's definitely not a peaceful place by any means right now, but comparatively speaking, has less conflict in many areas than has been the case for decades, if not centuries.
Yeah, totally. We're living in the most peaceful, really, time period that we've had throughout all history. You know, as like if you go with the very extensive evidence from lots of different places, but like, for example, Steven Pinker's book and lots of differing places. Like, so that's really interesting. But going on with your point, Ben, like, not only some of these messages that our leaders are giving us, but the messages that we give to each other, like the one that came to my mind was like testimony meeting. And as we were talking earlier about uncomfortableness with ambiguity, right? Like that word, I know, you know, you think about how many times that word is kind of presented to us. You know, if you think about testimony meeting, most people say it about 3 times, you know, and if you have what, like 10, 15 people speaking once a month, you know, that's like a very conservative, you could get a very conservative number, but like something like that where people are much more likely, due to our culture and the way that we talk and the way that we kind of communicate with each other, that message of knowing, you know, is so strong. And again, I think that has to kind of have some sort of an impact on perhaps some of the reasons why we are often so uncomfortable with uncertainty.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And that probably contributes to the difficulty of someone who's going through or has gone through a faith crisis, feeling like they speak a different language than their old friends that have not changed their faith at all, or their family members, just because the people who have not challenged their faith in this significant way have been primed by this I know language, among other things, for a long time. And it seems like to me, and there's exceptions always, but it seems like to break some of those long conditioned behaviors and ways of thinking, it takes something almost traumatic to break all that up.
And I guess a question I have based on that, and I don't know the answer to this question, but an interesting question to look into, would be, to what extent does that language of certainty that we're primed heavily with on Sunday carrying over into seemingly non-religious domains throughout the week and in our daily lives? Does that lead us to be less likely to have a tolerance for ambiguity in, say, our academic studies, our relationships with other people, or our political opinions, or whatever the case may be? And I don't know, but it seems to me that that's a hypothesis worth investigating.
Right, definitely. Yeah, I would guess that it would have some sort of an impact, but that's an interesting question.
And I guess it's not just the language of certainty and such, but we get all kinds of other kinds of primes as well. Primes for groupiness, for instance, for thinking in terms of in-group and out-group and loyalty and that kind of thing, which has its place, certainly. But how much of that is then bleeding over into our opinions and thoughts about, you know, our relationships with others, about societies, nationalities, political opinions, social opinions, you know, all these kinds of things? To what extent are those also being primed by the rhetoric of in-group loyalty and that sort of thing that we get very heavily in a Mormon context? And I guess, so these are two more kind of negative examples, but just not to be completely pessimistic here. I'd like to think as well that when we go to church on Sunday, we're also primed with faith, with hope and charity, kindness, service, forgiveness.
We're definitely primed to think about family.
Absolutely.
That would raise our awareness or our concern for those that we're related to.
Certainly. So I'd like to think that priming can also play a good role, you know, in our lives, in terms of helping us to hopefully be kinder to others throughout the week, subconsciously, with those things rolling around in our heads throughout the week as we interact with our coworkers and people we go to school with and families and all that kind of thing. So it's not always just we like to talk about priming like it's a nefarious, authoritarian, you know, kind of a, we'll manipulate you by feeding you subliminal messages, blah, blah, blah. And that's very rarely the case.
It's just a phenomenon that occurs.
It just happens.
It's not necessarily planned out.
Mm-hmm. And
although we could,
yeah, and it can work for as good as bad, oftentimes.
Yep, absolutely. Well, I was thinking about one of the examples that I talked about in that little section earlier, where like we have to kind of think about what that's one of the benefits of kind of better understanding primes is what are some of the goals, what are some of the attributes that we feel are vital in creating an environment where those are more likely to flourish. You know, for example, if your goal is to be productive and organized at work, if you always have messy desk and all of these differing things, that those kind of things can impact you. And in that same way, we like in regards to church, kind of recognizing that we are impacted by a lot of these things and maybe question whether some of these things are pointing us in the direction that we're really wanting to go versus hindering us.
Yeah. I think I can't remember if it was in the chapter or if I had just heard it elsewhere that all of these cognitive biases, they're a human condition. They're not something that only Mormons deal with or someone with a mental disorder deals with.
Or only religious people or anything like
just
that.
Just people or whatever. Yeah. They're universal, really. And there's not really a good way to avoid it 100%, but at least being aware of the phenomena or the specific phenomenon. Get my plural on singular. I know both. No, just kidding. But becoming aware of those, you can minimize their effect and you can have more rational thought, or at least you can process why you're doing that. And I've noticed as I've been reading this book, I've noticed a lot of these cognitive biases or the group think type behavior. I've noticed that in myself, censoring things at work that I think to myself, but then I'm like, well, if I say this out loud, then someone will think that, you know, I'm not performing well or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or if I'm in the presence of a superior, my boss or something, that I've just noticed myself omitting or behaving more gregariously. And, you know, being aware of that can help me to remind myself, okay, I need to fix this. I need to get all the information out, or, you know, just being aware of your behavior can help you amend it to some degree.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. We're not going to undo hundreds of millions of years of mammalian and primate evolution.
Exactly,
you know? But that's just not going to happen. But just like Brian said, taking the opportunity to be able to be self-aware enough to be able to reflect on your reactions and your behavior can do worlds of good. Because then at least you can understand, well, maybe that's why I'm reacting this way, and thus I can then make a more informed decision about what am I going to do about it. And I kind of like that, because we have a very strong tradition of that in Mormonism. We have a tradition of being independent and being the ones who act and not be acted upon, right? And I kind of think of priming as something that acts upon us without our awareness. And the more knowledge we have about how this works enables us to better be able to be the ones who can take more control of that and act instead of being just acted upon all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and maybe going with some of those things you guys were talking about, of how this isn't only necessarily like a Mormon thing or whatever. Like one area that I wanted to go, I'm not sure how involved you are, Ben, with like online Mormonism and some of those things, but I thought it would be interesting to maybe kind of dive in that area as well, kind of thinking about what are some of the primes that exist within that area. Because like for me, like I think there are so many like examples or so many differing things that can often, like one example, contribute to ideological polarization, which occur in the church as well. But like you see, like in the same way that maybe in sacrament meeting, you may be hearing, I know certain things, you know, you're going to be receiving similar or different messages within these kind of online communications and in some of these differing areas. I was just wondering if you guys had any thoughts on any of that.
Yeah, I think off the top of my head, I like doubt, but I think we fetishize doubt to some degree. like there's certain narratives that we hear a lot that I think are important, but I think we hear them a disproportionate amount, narratives of oppression of some sort, narratives of betrayal, those sort of things. We hear a lot of these stories that are true and real, but I think the online world, like podcasts like this, mm-hmm. you know, where people talk about faith transitions all the time and how their family's reacting, the Facebook groups and different blogs.
Or talk about ourselves as victims and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it all kind of like what Ben was saying, it's kind of a reactive position as we're constantly critiquing the church. The church says something, and then we react to it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's priming so much, but it's the behavior that I've noticed that is the blogger knuckle is not as diverse as it would like to think it is.
Mm.
No, that's true. I think it would be disingenuous for us to suggest that we're not as susceptible or as guilty of being influenced by primes from the messages and narratives of our community as any other community of any kind. That's for sure. And that reminded me of the, and I'm sure we've talked about before, I mean, the Heights Righteous Mind
yep.
stuff goes around a lot. Those kinds of primes come up a lot in these kinds of things, right? So in the more Orthodox Mormon groups, the primes are messages of purity, of authority, right? Of order and these kinds of things. Whereas just like Brian said, the narratives that maybe the online Mormon community groups are, I use the Liahona Mormon kind of groups, that's the label I like to use,
yeah.
Are the ones of fairness harm, right? Mm-hmm. Oppression, the freedom. Oppression, yeah. Yeah, like those kinds of things. And certainly, it's hard to be constantly exposed to those things, and then when something comes up in the church about a modesty article and the enzyme, or something to deal with women's issues or things like that, to not be influenced by that. And I'm not saying that that's bad that that happens. I'm just saying, but that's something that's happening, and we should be aware of that so that we can be more reflective about what we choose to do and the positions we choose to take and these sorts of things.
What about you, Brad Guy? Anything else that you noticed?
I think you guys covered that really well. Though, I mean, those were just some of the things I was thinking about. I often see individuals... like you were saying, these scripts, these things that we're saying, or like it, I mean, again, I might be getting away too far away from differing primes, but again, where we're putting ourselves in situations where we are only talking to certain types of people, you know, or so we're only allowing ourselves to be influenced by one particular group of individuals, and maybe they're people who think we're awesome or totally agree with us. And because we're only seeing those people, we're only seeing their arguments. We're not having to argue with people that we disagree with all the time. Because of that plays a role and that influences us as well. You know, so again, it just depends on your goals and what direction you're trying to go. But I see too often people putting themselves in situations where they become much more polarized and are not able to really which makes people a little less effective in trying to achieve what they're actually wanting to get.
No, I completely agree. And that's, again, this isn't something that's just a Mormon or a religious thing.
Yeah.
That's the story of what's happened in American political and civic society over the last 30 years as options for self-sorting into media environments have become available. Oftentimes we tell a story of 50 to 60 years ago, everyone was watching the same three news networks, right? ABC, CBS, and NBC. And everyone's working off that same thing. But as cable was invented, as the internet's invented, and most of us, at least those who are interested in politics and civics and that kind of thing, self-select our own news sources mm-hmm. in a way that confirm our thinking, and we talk to the people who think the same way as us. We've really created literally separate universes of perception of the way the political world works and such. And again, it would be naive to think that the same is not also going on in the religious world. And it very much is, right? We see the polarization of, say, evangelical and mainline Protestantism into more politically slash theologically conservative and politically slash theologically liberal camps. And I perceive at least a very similar thing going on in Mormonism right now, that same theological and political polarization going on, which has been enabled because of our ability to select the different sources from which we do this. And I think that's why we see a lot of the pushback, say, from the institutional church, because they're undoubtedly aware of that. And that's something that they're trying hard to avoid, is that balkanization of the community. They want really hard to keep it united and keep it together. And there's no easy fix to that. And I don't envy them that position that they're in, trying to balance individual freedom on one hand, but still institutional unity on the other hand. And I think that can lead them, as well as us, to sometimes making unwise decisions or acting a little bit rashly without thinking through quite the consequences of our actions.
We've already kind of talked about kind of ways that we can kind of be aware of this, of priming, and how that can kind of impact us and help us. But do you guys have anything else that you would want to say in regards to, like, how better understanding primes and some of the things we've been discussing can help us within a religious environment, but really just in general?
I guess one of my takeaway points that I take away from priming is that one of the lessons it shows us is that people's attitudes and opinions are not as stable as oftentimes we like to think that they are, even our own attitudes and opinions, right? Because we're so very susceptible to priming, when asked a particular question on any given day of the week, we might very well give a different answer depending on what we read in the newspaper just 30 minutes before.
And our blood sugar level.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right. That's a real physiological prime.
Yep.
Right, it's true. And I suppose we can use that to our advantage in a certain way as well. If there are certain goals that we have in a religious community, thinking about the way the priming works can maybe affect how we strategically frame our arguments, or say our sacrament meeting talks, or Sunday school lessons, or our blog posts. On one hand, if we're confrontational, then that immediately brings up the in-group, out-group, loyalty, protection, lack of tolerance for ambiguity, you know, that kind of thinking, because it's a feeling of threat, which sparks the black and white worldview and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. Whereas if we're intentionally, for a good reason, you know, trying to use primes in terms of empathy, community,
bridge building,
that kind of stuff. I would just talk about something, that's the kind of thing that's going to be rattling around in our heads as well as other people's heads throughout the week, as they then are confronting other situations, whether they be in their families or communities, online discussion groups, ward members, or things like that.
Yeah, and I think for me, it's it's kind of like the simple example of, you know, you're getting into an argument every day at 5:30 right before dinner. It's probably the blood sugar that's making you more agitated or making you angry, as I've heard. And so just being aware of that is like, okay, let me eat my roll or drink my Dr. Pepper or whatever I got to do, and then we'll, you know, continue talking about this. And so being aware of primes, it just helps me realize that I'm not in control of the way I think and feel about things as much as I would like to think that I am. And so it just gives me a little bit of humility about maybe not taking all my thoughts and feelings too seriously, and, you know, realizing that I'm being influenced by the media I consume and everything else around me.
Very good. And I think that would be a good place for us to kind of end out this conversation. So thank you so much, everyone, for listening. As always, we'd like to suggest that if you're enjoying the podcast, please go to iTunes and give us a review, as we'd love to hear your thoughts. And as well as that helps us to grow and to help others find who would appreciate the podcast to be able to find it. What's coming up in the future? What's coming up next week, Brian?
Well, I'm no prophet. Next week will be the book number 2 in the top 10 Book of Mormon history books discussion with Ben Park. And it is a overview of Rough Stone Rolling. And you'll find that Ben is a big fan of Richard Bushman, and he thinks Rough Stone Rolling is pretty awesome. But he also has some critiques.
Spoiler alert, Rough Stone Rolling's awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.
Keep keeping it weird.
Yeah, that's what we're supposed to say. Keep keeping it weird.